and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's schools out for summer. As Parliament goes off for its summer break, what was rushed through, buried, or overlooked? I'll be joined by UK editor John Ranson and Canary writer Steve Topple to go through the week with a fine-tooth comb. So, welcome, team.
Hello.
Hello.
So, John, what we're going to take a look at with you is just Theresa May's bizarre and horrific week. I mean, I was sort of off doing various bits of public engagement stuff this week. So I wasn't around much in the newsroom and it felt like it had been a quiet news week. And then I was sat there catching up. I was just like, this has not been a quiet news week. You know, like lots of stuff has happened, but it just seems like almost so much has happened. It felt like maybe the media didn't even know which way to look or what to focus on. So I wondered if you could just walk us through the week kind of from Theresa May's perspective.
It's been a strange week. It really seems like the Tories have actually set out to demolish everything that they've previously tried to build their reputation on. Mm. We tend to think that the Conservatives, at least, would like to see themselves as a party of high ethical standards. They like to see themselves as a party that encourages people to work. I mean, that's pretty obvious from the last few years. They like to see themselves as tough on things like drugs and misuse of drugs, and tough on law and order, and also as a party of pensioners, to be honest. I mean, you look at their conferences and it's pretty much all white hair, so they really are, you know, they've always been seen as a party that has a big following amongst pensioners.
Yeah.
And this week they've basically set out to demolish all of that, and I doubt they've done it on purpose, but anyway, they have. So on Monday, we had an announcement. It was fairly quiet announcement, and it was quite obscure. It was suggesting that political parties in Northern Ireland will have to disclose their sources of funding where they get donations over £7,500.
Right.
And all donations from the 1st of July this year, 1st of July 2017, right, over £7,500 will now have to be disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, oh, well, that sounds like a good thing. That sounds like transparency. But actually, this is a response to an amendment that was tabled in 2014 by Naomi Long, who's an Alliance MP in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that was an amendment basically to say that political donations in Northern Ireland should be made public as soon as the security situation allowed it.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, they were allowed to be secret because there was a fear that people making substantial political donations could become targets for terrorist groups.
Okay.
With the improving situation, thank goodness, there's been a move to increase transparency and to bring it into line with the rest of the UK. In that legislation that came out of that amendment from Naomi Long, the suggestion was to make that applicable from the 1st of January 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time it was slightly backdated, but it was everyone was working under the assumption that it would be the 1st of January 2014.
Yeah.
The fact that James Brokenshire, the Northern Ireland Secretary, has said it will apply from the 1st of July 2017 conveniently misses out two general elections, misses out a number of votes in Northern Ireland, and it misses out the EU referendum. And this is very significant because our friend Adam Ramsey at Open Democracy has done a fantastic investigation into the way in which Northern Irish parties actually influenced or may have influenced the EU referendum.
Right.
The DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, which of course is now, you know, standing in support of the Tories, basically trying to prop them up, they received, according to Open Democracy, a gift of £435,000 from a fairly little known organisation called the Constitutional Research Council.
Right.
of which the chair is a chap called Richard Kirk, who's a businessman, but he's also a former vice chairman of the Scottish Conservative Party. And the reason that this is a bit suspicious is that the DUP then went on to pay for an advert in the Metro newspaper, which is not a newspaper that people in Northern Ireland are reading. And they paid £282,000 for this advert. And it was promoting the Leave campaign. DUP have tended to be Brexiteers, despite everything that could entail for Northern Ireland. And they admit, the DUP admits it's paid for the adverts and that it used the donation. But with the exception of the Open Democracy investigation, we don't know for certain where that donation came from. There's been various wacky theories that it might have come from Saudi Arabia or all sorts. And the trouble is that now with this, if you like, forward dating of the new legislation, there's every chance that we won't ever be able to find out for certain anyway.
So this is a magic money tree situation again, isn't it?
Well, it kind of is. It's obviously there's been a certain amount of money flowing into and out of Northern Irish politics. And it's not just the DUP that want to keep it secret. Sinn Féin have also said that they don't want it to be backdated to 2014. And in fact, the only parties that have supported backdating it in Northern Ireland have been the Alliance Party and the Northern Irish Green Party. So, you know, it seems like perhaps a number of people have got skeletons in the closet.
Yeah.
The suspicion, understandably, is that maybe the Conservative Party in London has given the DUP a bit of a free pass on this. Obviously, people are going to suspect that that could be tied to the support that the DUP is giving to the Conservatives. Anyway, it all looks a bit murky.
Yeah.
And probably not the sort of high moral standards the Tories would like to be known for. And on Tuesday, we reported, Steve Topple reported, on a plan to bring in free childcare.
Yeah.
This was a pilot project where parents were able to get free childcare for their children. And the idea was it would help people to get out to work. You know, we're always saying the Tories, they want to get everybody out to work, regardless of if those people want to work or can work or should work or any of those things. Get to work. That's the only way that we're ever going to make Britain great again or whatever they want to do.
Absolutely. And never mind the wage for that work at all. You know, if they're
no, absolutely not. No. No, never mind anything, really. Just get them out to work. Make the unemployment figures look good.
Quite.
And so they did this pilot scheme, and the pilot scheme has now been analysed. And it turns out that, well, for a start, only 1% of mums and only 1% of dads actually started work because of this scheme. So in terms of getting people out to work, it was, you know, pretty much almost 100% failure. And very few people actually even increased their hours. 20-something percent among women and 9% among dads. So, you know, it had very little impact. And furthermore, the people who mostly took it up were people who were already fairly comfortably off. It didn't really impact the most needy people that it was supposed to help out. And then we've also heard that it wasn't great from the childcare provider's point of view either. There are suggestions that they've been barely getting enough to cover their costs, and that, you know, although they hoped it would be a business opportunity, that's not really worked out. So it seems so far this policy hasn't really helped anybody.
Can I just butt in at that point?
You certainly can.
Thanks. For me, just briefly, the main thrust of the results of this were, as John alluded to, that it was really only helping those in the higher socioeconomic statuses.
Yeah.
But also it's essentially another vehicle for private companies.
Yeah. And
nearly half of all the providers that were analysed in the study were private companies. 49% of them said the reason they joined was because it was going to benefit them financially. And furthermore, 55% of parents who were asked to report on their experiences of this additional free childcare said that they had to pay for some of the services anyway.
It's just an absolute joke.
Yeah.
That
was the other thing, wasn't it? There were extras
that
parents found themselves having to pay for.
Yeah.
Sometimes as well, they found they could only take the slots that nobody else really wanted. Because the most sought after slots, like, you know, when I suppose most people want to kind of get the kids off their hands, were more expensive, and people couldn't take them up under the free scheme.
Just to make the listener clear so they understand what this 33 hours childcare is, it's another 15 hours on top of what's already provided. But the way it works is that parents and guardians are given now 1,140 hours of free childcare a year, and it's up to them when they take this, if you like. Right. So it's almost like it comes now as a seasonal lottery, if you like, of parents scrabbling to get childcare, maybe during term time or during the school holidays when they can't take time off work or for whatever reason can't look after the child themselves. And as John said, some people are left with the scraps. And of course, what happened with this as well was that the report only came out on Monday. So as I was chatting to Angela Rayner about, she said there's very little that Labour can now do about it because Parliament ended on Thursday. So, of course... this is what the Tories always do.
This actually reminds me of workfare, in a way, is that you struggle to pick a conservative jobs policy, like a conservative economic policy, which is less effective than doing nothing at all. Basically, because when you looked at workfare, it was something like 25%. Of people who completed their workfare programs. And just to remind listeners, workfare programs are basically where the government says to people on job seekers allowance, you're not going to get your job seekers allowance unless you do a 13-week work placement for some corporation. So you're like stacking shelves for Tesco. So basically, instead of just having your benefits as normal, which would allow you to maybe do some training, do some relevant voluntary work, no, you're stacking shelves at Tesco or Poundland. So 25% of people that had made it to the end of their 13-week placement ended up with a job. So one in four. 44% of people ended up with a job who simply refused to do their workfare. So it's like almost twice as effective to do nothing with people who are unemployed than it is to put them on workfare. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And it's the same with the childcare stuff. You know, you've got to find people actually finding better situations for themselves outside of this ridiculous scheme than inside it. It's just laughable. And of course, the thing that makes it less funny is that public money goes into these schemes. You know, so we're blowing money left, right and centre, basically almost siphoning it into the pockets of private institutions and private organisations when we could actually just be, you know, funding decent things that worked.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just another example, if you like, of the creep of corporates into what was once the responsibility of the public sphere to provide this service.
There are lots of questions here, societal questions about, you know, how do we maintain work-life balance? How do we make sure that, you know, it feels like the Conservatives, as you say, Steve, they view a person simply as... their labour, you know,
exactly,
like their ability to generate cash for a private organisation, in this case mostly corporations. Actually, that's not the role of the government in terms of its view of its citizens. We should be looking at ourselves as citizens, not employees. You know, the citizens are going to be friends, they're going to be carers, they're going to be parents, guardians, partners. You know, there are lots of roles that people need to be playing outside of, you know, their function to make money for private corporations. And I think you're absolutely right that we're not anywhere near with this government actually starting to ask that question in any real way.
No, I mean, this is an issue which I don't think we're going to reach as a society for years, but it's endemic and it's symptomatic of the sort of hyper-capitalist corporatism agenda that is going on, and it's almost becoming dystopian in terms of the fact that we're all being turned into objects of labour and robotic instruments just to benefit the ruling class and make them more profitable.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to move on. I'm sorry, we're short on time. John, honestly, I could have carried on that theme for the rest of the show, but I'm conscious possibly more interesting for me than it is for the listeners, so I will stop. Mr. Ranson, you've, you know, Not to sound too Craig David about it.
Yeah, well, I've got as far as Tuesday. I've got as far as Tuesday lunchtime so far, and the Tories are already falling to pieces. They carried that on Tuesday afternoon, where there was a debate on drugs policy, led by Sarah Newton, who's the Tory spokesperson on that subject.
Yeah.
And there was an intervention by Norman Lamb from the Liberal Democrats, is their health spokesperson. And he pointed out that alcohol is regarded as the most dangerous drug in terms of harm. And what was the government's policy relating to that? And I guess this perhaps says something about the government, maybe, or the Conservative Party. I couldn't possibly speculate. But anyway, Sarah Newton immediately jumped on that and said, oh, no, alcohol's really not dangerous. so I wouldn't agree with the honourable gentleman that alcohol is the most dangerous drug.
She's sponsored by Carlsberg, by any chance?
Well, yeah, I mean, memories of Ken Clark with his glass of whiskey at the budget. But, it was, and she then kind of, she sort of wibbled along for a little while and basically kind of ended up saying, well, yeah, obviously I know that some people misuse alcohol and that causes all kinds of problems and it's all very sad, but, you know, most people are fine and most people can drink responsibly, which, to be honest, you could probably apply to almost any drug at all.
Exactly.
You know, I'm sure there are people who probably smoke responsibly, you know, to some extent, who knows. But it was such a misleading response, but also an ignorant response. You know, there's been very good studies into the relative harms of different drugs. There's a landmark study from 2010 that was published in The Lancet, which rated drugs based on their harm to the user and also on their harm to society, to other people. And on that measure, alcohol came out top. It's pretty bad for the user, but it's also extremely bad for other people.
Yeah.
All kinds of social problems associated with misuse of alcohol. On this scale, 0 to 100, it scored 72 and was considerably higher. I think heroin came next, then crack cocaine. But cannabis, for example, which was something that Norman Lamb mentioned, he said, you know, how did the government's policy on alcohol compare to their policy on cannabis? Yeah. And cannabis scores 20 on that scale of harms.
Yeah.
You know, there is some harm involved, both to the user and to other people, but compared to alcohol, it's considerably less. And this is a study that, you know, nobody's made a serious attempt at contradicting, you know, ever since. And it just seemed very, very disappointing that the Tory spokesperson on the subject was so clueless about it. And so I would say, you know, if the Tories want to be seen as a party that's strong on drugs, they ought to at least know their territory. And she quite blatantly didn't. She was completely exposed.
I think that's kind of part of the issue with this, because obviously there's the cynical aspect of the war on drugs here, which is, I mean, not hugely different. I mean, only different in terms of scale, as it is in the United States, where it's not a war on drugs at all. It's a way of criminalizing communities. And if you look at, you know, look at the situation from a sort of social power point of view, it's a way of keeping certain communities, be they ethnic or class, kind of in their place. And so really regressive, punitive drug laws essentially target those communities and make sure you can criminalize these people as young as possible. Make it as difficult as possible for them to achieve anything in their lives, and by so doing, continue to persecute that section of the population. And anyone who believes different, go and read all the studies on this. I mean, it's really, really disgraceful the way that these laws are used, essentially, to kind of, I mean, it's almost like kettling whole communities, you know, with but through the use of these laws. And obviously, the other side of it is you think, well, if we put that to one side for a minute and assume they're not all, you know, kind of racist, classist monsters. It's kind of that politics.
Good luck with that.
Exactly, because, you know, there is this issue, again, with particularly, it seems to me, with drug laws, is that the politicians seem to follow rather than lead. It's like we've generated a conversation about drugs, which is good drugs, bad drugs. Legal drugs are good drugs, and illegal drugs are bad drugs. And that's it. And that's the end of the conversation. And if you use the bad drugs, you're a bad person. Like, morally, you're a bad person.
Mm.
But there's nothing wrong with you for using the legal drugs, which are far more dangerous.
No, it's very, very childish, really.
Yeah.
And it's standing in the way of progress, and ultimately it's costing lives because
yeah.
people who need to be treated in the health system are being treated in the justice system.
Absolutely.
You know, which in many cases is making their problems worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, other countries have been far more progressive in dealing, you know, with issues arising from drug use. And Britain is really, really lagging behind. And, you know, it's a great shame. I definitely encourage listeners to go to the article on this, because there's, you know, there's quite a lot of extra information.
There's just one statistic I'd like to throw in, and then I'm saying nothing on this. There are 11.7 deaths per 100,000 people due to direct alcohol-related illnesses. That doesn't include indirect ones like throat cancer and so on. And there are 4.2 deaths per 100,000 people from direct drug-related conditions, overdoses, heart attacks, etc. So three times as many people nearly die from alcohol-related illnesses than do drug-related ones. And I'm going to shut up.
Thanks, Steve. It's an important statistic. I'm glad you shared it.
Hi, I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at the Canary. I wanted to take this opportunity to let you know how you can support the Canary and Canary Pod by becoming a member. We have various membership levels available with a monthly donation associated with each. And for each level, there are a range of benefits that you can get. So please take a look at www.thecanary.co/membership. And do remember to review, rate and subscribe to Canary Pod. That's the best way of more people getting to see Canary Pod and becoming new listeners, which would be fantastic. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, so we're actually covering events that happened on Wednesday in a separate podcast because they were pretty eventful, so we won't rehash that here.
Lurching on to Thursday, I hesitate to say lurching drunkenly, but in light of the previous story, quite possibly. The Tories, as I said earlier, have always been regarded as, you know, the party for older people, the party of pensioners. Mm. You know, if you're an older person, go with the Tories, because whatever they cut, they'll never touch your pension because they need your vote. But it seems like now they've given up on the middle-aged group of society, because during the week it was announced that people currently aged between 39 and 47 will now have to wait until they're 68 before they can pick up their state pension. This is because the rise to 68 is now being implemented from 2037, whereas previously it was going to be implemented from 2044. Okay. So it's brought it closer.
Yeah,
that's a change which will affect nearly 6 million people. So who knows? Maybe that's 6 million votes that the Tories just think they don't even need. That's their funeral.
Didn't it actually coincide with a report, like literally the same day or the day before, that was saying that actually mortality rates in society are rising? So like, whereas almost unbroken for about 40, 50 years, we've had, well, since the creation of the NHS, basically.
Yeah.
We've had consistently pretty much year on year. The average age that you can expect to live to nationally, we know that locally the picture is very different, but nationally overall would be rising. Well, now, as you know, and Steve's done a lot of work on this in terms of actually you could have seen the warning signs of this happening, as increasingly poorer communities were seeing their average age of living start to fall. And that now seems to have got to such a saturation point that the national average looks to be stalled or lowering for the first time in decades.
This policy has been based on the assumption that life expectancy is rising.
Yeah.
And clearly the policy isn't keeping step with reality, because as you say, life expectancy, I believe it was announced this week, is now stalled in Britain as a whole. The truly shocking thing about this is that, as you say, there are significant regional variations. Mm. There are regions of Britain where the life expectancy is actually less than 68.
Yeah.
Which means that, you know, for some people, they're not going to get their pension in their lifetime. They're going to miss out completely. And it just, to me, it just suggests, once again, the complete ivory tower that the Conservative Party lives in.
Yeah.
You know, they probably look around their friends who are all, you know, with their private healthcare and whatnot, are all sort of living long, healthy lives.
Yeah.
You know, they perhaps maybe they base it simply by looking at the royal family who seem to live forever. And yet around the country, you know, people are literally going to be dying before they're eligible for the state pension.
Yeah.
And there's an important side note I'd like to make on this briefly, that I wrote about this in May, and everyone was recoiling in horror that they've announced the state pension age is rising. Mm. The Conservatives, by the 7th of May, were legally supposed to have announced what was happening with the state pensions age. Yeah. It was a mechanism which they wrote into pensions reform law, and the Conservatives didn't do this by the 7th of May, purely because, in my opinion, obviously, they knew that it would probably be a vote loser for them. So the Conservatives stalled this announcement. It was supposed to be done before the general election.
It wasn't in the manifesto either.
They claimed that they couldn't make the announcement because of the election purdah laws, the restrictions on making announcements. But I think everybody saw through that straight away.
That is nonsense, because the purdah laws specifically state that when there's a clause about national interest where purdah can be overridden. And that was specifically that is, I mean, 6 million people, I'd say that's national interest.
Totally.
I mean, I just don't know what they're playing at, John. I really don't know what. I mean, it's like in the last election, I was at a conference run by Loughborough University this week, and they were actually going through the data from the 2017 general election. Like, what did it actually look like? And it was in terms of media coverage, in terms of, you know, the votes, you know, as they came out. And they were looking at the demographics, and basically in every age group, electorally under the age of 50, Labour got a majority. And I mean, it was a massive, you know, massive majority in the 18 to 24s, and still really thumping majorities in pretty much literally every age demographic under 50. And it looks like, you know, it's kind of like the Tories are hanging on to kind of the folks with grey hair in the hopes that they'll save them at the ballot box. They've decided to commit like Harry Carey or something. They've just gone, right, what can we possibly do to make ourselves less popular than we are now? I know. Let's go after our older, most vulnerable members of society and our core voter group. What?
No, it really is staggering. It does seem like they've certainly got no long-term vision whatsoever, because, you know, as I say, this affects people between the age of 39 and 47 now.
Yeah.
And I think they're deliberately targeting the Canaries editorial team, but there we go. But the in 20 years time, those people will be 59 to 67. Quite. You know, they'll be the sort of people that the Tories have traditionally regarded as, you know, good voters for them in 40 years, even more so. And yet the way they're carrying on, you know, why would anyone who's currently in their early 40s and is realizing that, you know, their pension is moving away from them faster than they can catch up with it, why would they ever think of voting Tory in the future? I don't know. There seems to be no strategy to it whatsoever. They talk about sustainability, but they use that word totally wrong. You know, sustainability is supposed to mean ensuring that the next generation has things as good as the current generation.
Yeah.
That's where the word derives from in terms of things like climate change and environmentalism.
Yeah.
The Tories seem to use it as a euphemism for spending as little money as possible.
Absolutely.
And that's not sustainable.
No.
it's a total contradiction in terms.
So, John, we've done Thursday. Is there anything else that rounded off Theresa May and the Conservatives week from
now? Well, we've nearly done Thursday. the Tories' number one claim for such a long time. I mean, they've had two claims. One is that they're the party that's strong on the economy, but that's such a ridiculous joke, I don't think anyone believes that anymore. Their other idea is that they're the party of law and order.
Yep.
And that's something that they've really made a big deal of year after year after year. Mm. And so it will be pretty disappointing for them to look at the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics on recorded crime, which show that in the last year it's gone up by 10%.
10%.
And within that, theft's gone up by 10% for overall recorded crime.
Yeah.
The Conservatives prefer to use another measure, because there are two different ways of counting crime. And there's one based on a survey of victims, and that shows a 7% reduction. But that's excluding certain offences. Right. And as I say, it's not the recorded crime measure. In terms of recorded crime, up by 458,021 in the previous year to nearly 5 million. So that's an increase of pretty much 10%. And within that, theft up by 7%, robbery by 16%, sexual offences by 14%, violent crime by 18%, gun and knife crime by 20%, and public order offences up by 39%. So, you know, whatever the Tories want to stake their reputation on, you suspect they're probably going to do everything they can to ignore those figures, to try and gloss over them.
Yeah.
And, you know, where you sort of think, what might be causing that? Well, you know, Theresa May was Home Secretary from 2010 until fairly recently, when she moved up a couple of notches. You know, it doesn't really look good for her. Obviously, we've talked in the past about the cuts to police officers and the general pressures, I would say, on the police. It's not just cuts in number of officers, it's issues like the number of officers going on sick leave, for example, because of the pressures of the job, trying to cope with vastly squeezed resources. The general kind of issues that could be driving this, it's certainly got some parallel to the late 1980s, when there was a sharp rise in crime. And a report by the London School of Economics suggested that this was probably closely related to the socioeconomic circumstances at the time, particularly the kind of the mass unemployment that we saw as a result of Thatcherism, and also the inequality, the fact that often deprivation was concentrated into specific geographic areas, you know, was a problem. And, you know, we've seen very similar things under this latest round of Tory rule: stagnating wages, again, I say inequality, very little investment into housing, particularly into social housing. You know, and we've had the whole debate in the aftermath of the Grenfell tragedy about the very poor conditions, you know, that many people have to live in.
Yeah, as you say, I mean, it's a whole vicious cycle, isn't it? I mean, often we've got to think before we leap in terms of crime stats, because obviously you can have certain situations where you've invested in more police, you've invested in, say, programs to improve the reporting of crime, and you can actually then get your crime stats get worse because more people are reporting crime and there are more officers on the streets to deal with the crime. But as we say, in this situation, that's highly unlikely to be the case because the government has taken all of the opposite steps.
No, I mean, that might account for small increases in perhaps particularly targeted crimes. You know, if there'd been a push to target knife crime, for example, you'd expect a spike. But I mean, this is a 10% overall increase.
Yeah,
you know, it's very, very substantial.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, it's, you know, the double whammy, really, of, you know, you've got the government actively making it harder for us to fight crime by you know, removing 20,000 police officers from the streets, but also, I mean, as important as that, you know, just withdrawing money from kind of local community centres and community work, which would stop the crime happening in the first place. You know, it's 'cause, you know, you're driving people towards crime by putting them in such poverty and destitution that, frankly, some people have got no other choice. You know, and as you say, John, it's, I mean, eerily reminiscent of the sort of, you know, mid to late 80s, you know, where you sort of started to feel the fabric of society kind of breaking down under the weight of Thatcherism.
Well, quite. I think the 80s is often regarded as the decade of individualism, and it was a time when a lot of social structures broke down. I think between the start of the 80s and the end of the 80s, there was a big difference, certainly in how, say, for example, children and young people would have perceived their communities.
Yeah.
At the start of that decade, they would have felt probably that people were aware of what they were doing and sort of had an eye on them, and by the end they were, you know, free to run riot. And during the current Tory rule, we've seen absolute demolition of the youth service provision. You know, in Norfolk, where I live, youth work has been cut pretty much to nothing. You know, pretty much every youth club has closed, every youth worker is now redundant. People involved in youth work always knew that it was the front line in crime prevention,
yeah.
as well as being a powerful force for improving society.
Yeah.
It was also the front line of defence, if you like, against social problems.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, any government that doesn't just cut youth provision, but completely removes it, vainly hoping that perhaps voluntary groups will step into the breach, which clearly they have in some cases, but, you know, it's a hope, it's not a policy, yeah. To then sort of turn around and look at the crime figures. I think it would, you know, it's highly likely, certainly to me,
yeah.
that they're not unrelated. And it's just this disregard for the social fabric of society, you know, just as with this thing for seeing people as kind of employment units yeah. rather than people.
Yeah.
You know, it's bound to have an increase, bound to have an effect on you know how the society works.
Can I just chip in at this point?
Yeah.
I think what John's saying is very right, and I think we need to look at it in terms of the system we live under, both globally and locally in the UK. The financial system and the systems of governments are essentially eroding society away at the moment on every single level. And I know at the start you called this program, Kerri-Anne, the fact that school's out for summer.
Yeah.
I think that we as the left and organisations and political groups and activists needs to take the summer to think about how we're going to move forward, because yep. we're seeing mass erosion of society. And I think if school's out, then we need to be looking at how, when we go back to school, we're going to address this, because it's now becoming one of the biggest challenges of our generation. Exactly what kind of society we want to live in, and that tipping point is coming, if you like.
Absolutely, and yeah. I think that's the perfect place to wrap up this week's show, because as we say, government is going into recess this week, but we're not. The Canary will be continuing to write, you know, every day, 7 days a week, and we will be here at Canary Pod at the end of each week for you with the wrap up. So we are going absolutely nowhere. I'd like to thank Steve and John for joining me this week. Guys, you've done a sterling job all week and an excellent job of wrapping up today. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved. Sorry.